Okay, we're starting here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Nun Aleph Amud Bet. Mishnah says a bechor notel pishnayim benichse ha'av. The bechor is entitled to a double portion in the father's possessions. Ve'eino notel pishnayim benichse ha'ei. But he's not entitled to a double portion in his mother's possessions. Ve'eino notel b'shevach. The ability to take, or his privilege to take the double portion, does not apply to shevach, that's the increase in the value of the property after the death of his father. We're going to see that in the Gemara. There are two possibilities of the increase in value. One is that it happens memela, by itself. I mean, after his father passed away, the estate increases in value without any input from anybody else. Or, the other possibility is that the estate was invested in by the brothers or by part of the family, and therefore went up in value. Either way, the bechor is not entitled to that increase in value as a double portion. He's like any one of the other brothers, so he'll be entitled to a single portion in that, but not a double portion. Velo b'ra'ui k'mukzak. Velo b'ra'ui k'mukzak means that it has to be something that's actually present now. Can't be something that will come in the future, or something that will come into the estate. For instance, if you have a relative who passes away, and the inheritor of that relative is their father. Their father's no longer alive. So they become the proxies for their father, and they will inherit instead of their father. But that piece that comes is after their father's death. After their father's death, he no longer has that entitlement to a double portion. And therefore, if Uncle Joe leaves them an inheritance through their father, he will only get a single portion like everybody else, not a double portion. Now, if Uncle Joe had passed the inheritance prior to their father's death, then it would be part of the father's estate, and he would get a double portion of that. But ra'ui ki mukhzak. Mukhzak means that they actually have it in hand now. Ra'ui means something that will, in the future, come. He doesn't have an entitlement to a double portion of that. V'lo aisha biktubata, v'lo abanot bizonetehem. A woman, with regards to her ktubah, has these same restrictions as the bechor. Meaning that, if she comes to collect her ktubah, Ktubah is basically a debt. She's a creditor to the estate in order to collect her ktubah when her husband passes away. So she's entitled to come to the estate and take the money for her ktubah. But the exceptions to that are her entitlement to go and take the property is not true when it comes to the shevach, and it's not true when it comes to ra'ui kimukzak. The same is true for benot b'mizonetehem. Daughters with regards to Mizonot, the feeding of the daughters. It's a machloket, Rashi and Tosafot, about what this is speaking. Rashi claims, v'lo abonot, she'em mekabel olav, lazunet bita, she'ayala mi'ish acher 5 shanim. That there was a practice, a general practice, that if a man married a woman who had previously been married and had children, that he would agree to support those children that she brings into the marriage for 5 years. So Rashi claims that's what we're talking about here. These benot b'mizonotehen is that the husband, it's basically the stepfather, agrees to support this daughter for 5 years. And that's what we're speaking about here. Tosafot takes two issues with that. The first being that this is something that should be equal to banim and banot. There's no reason that you should single out the daughters. This should be equally plausible as a scenario between a stepfather to a son and a stepfather to a daughter. So I don't know why you said banot v'mizanotehem. It could have been banim v'mizanotehem. That's the first question Tosfot has. The second question Tosfot has is, he doesn't understand. The Gemara is going to say that habanot v'mizanotehem is tanai ketubah, is a part or condition of the ketubah. He says this is an independent agreement between the stepfather and the woman that he will support her children. It has nothing to do with the ketubah. It's an independent agreement between them. How could you call that a tanai ketubah? Therefore, Tosafot suggests that this benot b'mizonotehem is talking about the children, the mizonot that his daughter is entitled to. So Tosafot explains, b'yatomim ayri, we're talking about orphans, hachadumia de benot b'mizonotehem, the mazonisha v'abanot in govim minichasim mishubadim. We're talking about children that were orphaned over here, and the father has to take care of these children to give them mizonot. And that's true of a wife. He has to feed mizonot to his wife. That's what she's entitled to as part of the ketubah. And he has to feed mizonot to these children. Ela bizon ba bat, shehu nai beit din, Airi, v'hani lo gabe b'mishabde. It's a part of the Tanai Ktuba that a father takes care of the children, he'll provide them mizonot. According to Rashi, that has nothing to do with his own children. It has to do with the stepchildren that he's taking on, that he's acquiring. That has the same limitations. Whether according to Rashi, it's the agreement between this stepfather and the new wife, or between the father and his wife, that part of the ktubah, he will support the children and give them mizonot. When they come to claim those mizonot, they're not entitled to take it from certain things, like the bechor. Enotel b'shevach, enotel b'ra'oik mukzak, and he doesn't take also mimishubadim. You can't take it from encumbered property. All of those things you can't go after with the mizonot of the wife and the mizonot of the children. And that's what Tosafot says we're speaking about here. V'lo yabam. A yabam is someone who marries his brother's wife. His brother had no children, and he left his wife a widow. Then the brother comes to perform yibum. When the brother performs yibum, he steps into the shoes of his former brother, and he inherits like his former brother. Actually, he becomes almost like a bechor. He gets his own portion in the Yerusha, plus the Yerusha of his brother, who he's filling in, the shoes he's filling in for. Therefore, he also gets a double portion. That again is, Einot li b'shevach lo b'roik mukhzak. He also will only get his brother's portion with regards to things that are in the estate already, but not with regards to things that come afterwards. So we have the Shevach and the Roi B'Mukzak will be left out in these two instances. The Gemara is going to go through each of these items and we'll learn why. First thing the Gemara wants to know is about the Bechor. How do we know that he's Notel Pishnayim Ba'av and not Ba'aim? How do we know that it only refers to the father's possessions and not the mother's possessions? My time, Amakra, Velo Mishpat HaBechora. So he has the Mishpat HaBechora. Mishabat HaBechora, the Ish, Ve'Mishpat HaBechora, the Isha. There is a Mishpat HaBechora for the man, but there is no Mishpat HaBechora for the woman. So you would think the Pashtut is, and that would be true as well, that it's talking about the inheritor. The inheritor has to be a male. This only applies the din to a male Bechor, not to a female Bechor. That's not what we're speaking about here. As Rashi points out, the Lo Mishpat HaBechora is referring to the Av, the father. That's when it's Lo Mishpat HaBechora. And he says it's an extension. He who reshito no, lo mishpata bechora. But they're doing that because the way they're reading it is, ki hu reshito no, lo mishpata bechora is not referencing reshito no, but rather it's referencing back to the father who is giving it. So velo mishpata bechora is the father at the time of death creates the mishpata bechora. So it's not referencing the reshito no, which would be the son, but rather the father. It's written in the male form. And therefore, only the father's possessions enter into the pot for pishnaim of the bechor. Mother's possessions don't enter in that. And as Rashi says, mashma da'adidei kai, komar, b'nechasav mishpat bechora, v'lo b'nechasei ishto. That's what it means, reshito no. Lo, with regards to the father, mishpat bechora. Mishpat bechora only applies to the father, does not apply to the mother. Again, it's not the Pashtut HaPasuk. Pashtut HaPasuk, again, is dealing with the actual Bechor. But happens to be that's true as well, that it's only a male Bechor, not a female Bechor, that would inherit. All right, now, Ve'eino notel b'shevach. How do I know that? Because it says in the Pasuk, Bechol asher yimatzeh lo. Everything that's there at the time, whatever's found then, that's where you get the Bechorah. Ve'lo b'ro'i k'mukzak. And how do I know lo b'ro'i k'mukzak? It's the same thing, Dechiv, Bechol asher yimatzeh lo. So all of these items tell you that it's got to be in place at the time of the death of the father. That's where you have the entitlement to the Mishpat HaBechora, not any time after that. So anything that comes after that, which includes Shevach, which comes afterwards, as well as Ra'oi B'Mukzak, both of those come after the fact. Therefore, you will not be entitled to a double portion. Below Aisha B'Ktubata, woman by Ktubaz Ini, is that really true? Barmer Shmuel, Balchov Govat Shevach. That a Baal Chov is entitled to go after the Shevach. So now, Rashi claims over here that Baal Chov went after the Shevach. This is a creditor who has an entitlement, an encumbrance on the debtor's property. The debtor sells the property to buyers. And the buyers improve the quality of the property. They improve the property. And then the Baal Chov comes and says, I want my money. The debtor has no money. So he goes after the property that these buyers took. When he takes that property, he's allowed to take the property plus the improvements that they invested in the property. So that's true of a balchov, and by the way, it's true according to Rashi. Rashi has to set it up that way, that we're talking about the kuchot over here, because of the way Rashi set up the case in the Mishnah. Rashi set up the case in the Mishnah that it's mekabel olav lazuret bita, she'ela mishacher chamesh shanim. So over there, it's the equivalent of an agreement like l'kuchot. And therefore, he can go after the, what we're talking about here, the shevach, he can go after these buyers and get the shevach. Now, the Gemara's point is that a ketubah is the same thing as being a creditor. She basically has an outstanding debt that is owed to her. So why can't she collect just like a creditor? Amar Rabbi Abba, mikulei ketubah shanukan. This is one of the kulot of a ketubah. That a ketubah doesn't function exactly like a regular creditor or a regular debt that's outstanding. It's true that in terms of the letter of the law, the ketubah should function just like a balchov. But the Chachamim instituted it when they made the ketubah collectible and made it as an encumberment on the husband's property, or there should be a lien on the husband's estate. They said that only with regards to a regular balchov. They did not say that with regards to the ketubah. The ketubah is not given that full power or that full strength. And Tosfot says over here, the case that we're speaking about here, Havadai hadakamre hocha de'inan govot shevach, kim keren, that they can only take the shevach, and the keren is hanami yatme velomlim kuchot. It's not talking about from buyers, it's talking about from the yitomim that left in the estate. Rashi, who establishes the case as being an outside case, where he has an agreement with his stepdaughters that he's going to feed them, Rashi says that he's even entitled there to go after the shevach of the lekuchot, of the buyers of this property. Then Tosafot reads the case as being his own children that he's chayav to provide mizonot for. In that case, Tosafot says you're not entitled to go after the kuchot when it comes to mizonot. Because mizonot, haisha, vahabanot, you're not entitled to go after mishubadin. So it has to be that we're talking about that they're going after the property of the yitomim. They have a claim against the property of the yitomim. And in a claim against the property of the yitomim, over there you're entitled to take from the keren. You're not entitled to take from the shevach when it comes to the property of the yitomim. So that's why the difference between the way Rashi explained the Mishnah now has impact on how we explain what it means to bachov gove min shevach. The way Tosafot explained the Mishnah will also have who's the bachov going after over here. So according to Rashi, the bachov is going after the buyers. But according to Tosafot, the bachov is going after the yitomim. It's going after the inherited estate that the yitomim have.
Something that she's interested in, and therefore she's not granted that access.
Correct. I mean, that's a general principle. Whenever you see something in ketubah where it differentiates from balchov, we know that in balchov, they gave much more access to creditors in order to keep the market liquid and open. If you prevented creditors from going after certain properties or certain extras, they would stop lending because they have no way to protect their loans. On the other hand, a woman has an incentive besides the ketubah to get married. Her primary purpose in getting married is not the ketubah. That's secondary to getting married. It's a protection mechanism for her, but it's not the primary purpose. And that's what you were mentioning, that it's tov l'meitav b'tandu. She wants to get married, and therefore we're able to reduce her rights within the ketubah without affecting a woman's want and desire to get married. And therefore the Chachamim balanced between those two, meaning strengthening the balchov in many instances. Whereas the ketubah ta'isha, that's why we're talking about kulot in the ketubah ta'isha, is because, again, that's a secondary factor, not a primary factor, and it won't impact on people getting married. And that's why you have to balance between those two, and that's in many gzeirot, we say that in Gittin and in many places, that difference between a balchov and a ketubah. All right, now these big Tosafot over here are discussing a very interesting issue, which is, we're not going to go into it so much, but he mentions over here, you can see it in the first line of the Tosafot by the Mishnah. He says, "V'lo b'roik muvzak v'perish g'yosh nochlim paskin and hilkata deina b'chor notel pishnayim b'milve ben shegavu ma'ot ben shelo gavu ma'ot." The father was an outstanding creditor to another party. The b'chor does not have a right to get a double portion in that loan that is outstanding. Omitov kach nira deina govak ktuba b'milve. And from that you would conclude that the ketubah has the same din as a bechor. That the ketubah should have no entitlement to go after the outstanding loans of the father.
Bonds. Nowadays the person's a big bondholder. So the bechor doesn't have double rights on bonds.
Right. It's very possible that it's that case here. Bonds might be...
Yeah, I could also sell the stuff. Oh, that the bond is...
But it's not...
Now, they viewed outstanding loans as being a zero, that what the shtar chov was worth nothing. That it itself, at the time, it's not considered mukzak, and therefore Tosfos is saying that the board does not get entitlement to that.
But in our case, we have a bond market.
Right, so today might be different, and there's also the takanat geonim.
Also, those days you would sell a shtar.
Collect. But that's the same as today. A bond is discounted to the value and the credit that's out there. But that's not given value. At the time of the death, they don't assess the value of the shtar chov. They don't give it inherent value. The Gemara views the shtar chov as worthless in terms of the actual item. Yes, it gives you the right to collection. But a right to collection is not value at this moment. You could sell it, you could monetize it, but at this moment, the time of the death, it's not given value. Right? Which presents issues today, like what you're suggesting over here with the bond markets and bonds today, that we do assign value to them and we assess them as real value. So there is a takanat geonim. We saw this many times in Ketubot. Tosfot always mentions it, and of course here he's going to mention it again, that the Gaonim were mitakein, that because of the change in times, meaning that the time of the Gemara, land was considered the best safety deposit. It was the item that everybody relied on, and therefore, when we had liens, the liens only went on land, whereas in the time of the Gaonim already, people became merchants, and therefore there's a possibility they didn't own any property, and all of their estate was in metaltalim. And therefore, the Gaonim made it that metaltalim have the same din as land. The metaltalim are equal to Meshubadim, and therefore you can have liens on metaltalim, something the Gemara never recognized. The Gaonim did that. They were metakin in that way. So now, as far as bonds are concerned, they still wouldn't even reach that level of metaltalim. They're not even considered, they are metaltel, but they don't have inherent value, according to the Gemara. Question is, that would he say that today? That today, since people rely on those as real assets, can you then say that the lien applies, just like the Gaonim applied it to metaltalim, that would we apply that also to bonds and say that they have monetary value and they have real value today? There's if, the equivalent of holding a currency in your hand. It's equivalent of holding a dollar bill or a shekel.
Stocks that don't pay dividends.
No, but there he has ownership. It's evidence of ownership. There he has real ownership in the property.
He's not getting dividends.
Doesn't matter. He's not getting dividends, but he has ownership. The ownership is something that's tangible at that moment.
Bonds also.
That's different. It's not a liquidation. There, it's an IOU, and the money is not here yet. Somebody will pay you in the future. It's evidence that they owe you the money. A stock certificate is evidence of ownership. Ownership, you can inherit. Exactly. So I think that you could differentiate between. I still say that it's a possibility, like just like the Goni we're talking with the Gabe Metaltalim, that today we would view bonds and outstanding securities like that as being real value, and that maybe the Bechor would get Motel Bishtayim. But the big Tosafot is about proving this point. That first of all, Bechor is not entitled to it. But the second point which he made is that he extends it to Ketubah. He says that's not true. And that he thinks that by Ketubah Tisha, that she's considered Mubzeket, and she can take, a Ketubah can take from a Milveh. So he differentiates between a Bechor and a Ketubah Tisha. Despite the fact that the Mishnah here equates them, Tosfot sets out to prove that they're different. And that the Ketubah Tisha does have entitlement to the credit, the outstanding credit of the husband. Whereas the Bechor does not have that ability to get a double portion of the outstanding credit of the father. That's really what these big Tosafot are really dealing with. I'm not going to take the time to go through all of his proofs, but I want you to know what it's speaking about, because they're such large Tosafot, and they deal with these issues. All right, so now the Gemara continues. What about V'lo Abanot B'Mizonotehem? How come there they don't get B'Shavach, and they don't get in the Ma'uik Mugzak? The Gemara answers, because Naik Tubak Tubak Dami. Since it's an extension of the Ketubah, it's a part of the Ketubah, condition of the Ketubah, therefore it's like the Ketubah. This is one of Tosafot's claims against Rashi, which is the support of a stepchild is outside of the Ketubah. It's an independent agreement, and therefore how could you call that a Tanai Ketubah? Whereas what he's suggesting is that it's the person's own children that they're chayav to provide mizonot for, and that's a part of the Ketubah, that they will provide those mizonot, and that's why it's considered to be a Tanai Ketubah. V'lo yabam. My time. How come by the Yabam they don't have the right to Shevach and Oy Mugzak? Because Bechor Kariyah Rachmana, the Torah calls him a Bechor. Because when it comes to the Yabam, it says Vayah HaBechor Asher Teled, the Bechor that is born. Now the Pashtut again of the Pasuk is the first child that is born will be Yakum Hashem Achiv Hamet. He will replace the name of his father, meaning that he will be as if he's the child of the deceased brother. But the Gemara doesn't read it that way. They read the word Bechor there to be referencing the brothers that are still alive. The brothers that are alive have Bechor. The oldest brother is the one that should perform Yibum. So you see that the Gemara darshans the word Bechor not to be referencing the child that is born to this Yibum, but rather to the miyabim, the one who's going to perform the yibum. He has to be bechor. He should be the oldest of the brothers. And number two is he's called a bechor. He's considered or classified as a bechor, and therefore you have the same dimin as a bechor. So Amar Abaye, loshna ela b'shevach sheshibchu nechasim ben mita liyibum. This is only true about the increase in value that transpired between the death of, and the completion of the yibum. Aval ben yibum lechalukah shakil. Once he already has performed yibum, he now becomes his brother. And becomes his brother, just like his brother would have been entitled to the increase in value, so too does he. He stepped into his brother's shoes, he's now his brother. My time, because it says, Yakum Hashem Achiv Amet, that he replaced his brother who was deceased. Zivara Marachmana Baharikam. Torah says that he will replace him, and now he has replaced him. Once he's replaced him, he becomes like his brother, just like his brother would have been entitled to the Shevach, so too would he. Rav Amar, Afilu Ben Yibum Lechalukah Nami Lo Shakyo. Says, even after the performance of Yibum, till the time that the inheritance is divided, he also doesn't get it. My time, huh? Ke Bechor. It's just like a Bechor. Ma Bechor in lo kodem chalukah. Av Yabam, nami in lo kodem chalukah. Just like a Bechor has no entitlement from the time of his father deceases till they split the estate, he's entitled to nothing in terms of the Shevach. So too this Yabam, from the time of his father's death, until the time that they divide the estate, he's entitled to nothing. Even if he steps into his brother's shoes, even if he performs Yibum. The Yibum that he's performing is after the father passed away, but before they divide the estate. So Abaye says, from that moment of Yibum, you stop considering or classifying him as an inheritor of his brother. Instead, he becomes his brother. Rava says, no, that the Din of Bechor applies fully to this Yibum, and therefore he's entitled to no Shevach that transpired after the death of the father.
So he becomes a brother, but he doesn't become a...
From the moment that he performs the Yibum, he becomes the brother.
A brother, not a Bechor.
Before that point, he's a Bechor. Till he marries this woman, he's the Bechor, because he's going to marry her. So that's, in that area, he's treated like a Bechor. From the moment he marries her, he becomes his brother. He becomes the brother. He steps into his shoes. So that means, until the point of marriage, he functions like a Bechor, and any Shevach that happens, he's not entitled to. From the moment he marries, he performs Yibum, then he becomes his brother, and he's like a regular individual.
But the Bechor portion, so Abai is not even dealing with the Bechorah.
Every person in the estate divides up evenly the estate at the time of their father, plus there was an increase in value of the estate from the time their father passed away to the time they divided. That increase in value is divided evenly between the brothers. The question is, this brother was passed away. The brother that passed away doesn't have that. He was not around to get that Shevach. When does the Yavam take over for him? According to Rava, he never does. He's always classified as a Bechor. The moment of Yerusha for him is the moment that the father died, and therefore he takes over his brother at the moment of death, but nowhere after that. That's Rava's position. Whereas Abaye believes is, yes, he only is entitled to the portion of the brother from the time of the father's death, but then he enters in again to the fray from the time he performs Yibum. Once he performs Yibum, he's no longer a Bechor, he becomes his brother. And when he becomes his brother, he's entitled to divide like all the other brothers in the Shevach that the estate has after the death of the father. It's nothing to do with the Shevach beforehand. It has to do with the Shevach that's happening right now, the increase in value. Therefore, Abaye says that before performing Yibum, he's a Bechor. After he performs Yibum, he's his brother. Rava says he's always classified as a Bechor. And therefore, from the moment the father died, the estate has nothing to do with him. His portion, his brother's portion in that, is divided by all the brothers equally. He doesn't have an extra portion in that. Okay, but Kulan ain't no tlim b'shevach. All of them can't take the shevach. Now the question is, why did the Mishnah repeat that at the end? The Mishnah began with that, and then it says b'chein the isha b'tuvah, b'chein the benot b'zenotem, and then it repeats it at the end. Kulan ain't no tlim b'shevach, v'lo b'roik mukzak. Why is that? So what is that? Le'etuye shivcha d'memeibo. That it comes to include, this is what I mentioned to you on the Mishnah, shevach can have manifestation in two ways. One is that it happens by itself. The estate increases in value by itself. The other way is that the estate is invested in, and therefore it increases in value. So what the Gemara is coming to say is that you would have had a havamina, that the only Shevach he's not entitled to is Shevach of investment by the Yitomim. But Shevach that happens, appreciation that happens by itself, he would be entitled to a double portion in that. That's what the Mishnah comes to preclude and say no. He's not entitled to either Shevach. He's not entitled to Shevach of investment. He's also not entitled to the Shevach of appreciation that happens b'meila by itself. Like, for instance, chafura v'avu shubli, shafufe v'avu tamre, which is grains that were shachat Bishat mitato, they were only a third of the growth, they were hay, they weren't fully grown yet. Bechshav nasu shibalim, now they came in fully grown, they're matured. Or, shofufe is a smadar, it's the blossom or the beginning of the fruit on the tree. And now they're tamarim gdolim, they're regular dates. So, I mean, they didn't have to do anything for that to happen. They were growing. The grains were growing, the fruits were growing, without any input from the brothers. So when the father died, they were smaller, and now they're much larger, but that all happened by itself. So you would think that maybe that he is entitled to a double portion. And the Mishnah comes to tell you, no, Shevach is Shevach, and he gets no double portion in that. This is an interesting part. The Ro'ibim Muvzak, we said, is the property that falls to the father after his death, and his sons become the inheritors because of their father. So there are different ways that their father can inherit. It could be that his father passed him Yerusha, and then he's passing it down to his children. He predeceased his father. Their grandfather is still alive, the father passes away, and then the grandfather dies. When the grandfather dies, the property will go straight to the grandchildren, because the father's not there. But they're entitled to that through their father. Now with regards to the grandfather, there is no doubt that it's going to end up with these boys. Because the grandfather will pass it to their father for sure, and then for certain they will get it. On the other hand, when it comes to like uncles or great uncles who they would inherit as well, there's chances that they will inherit or they won't inherit. Meaning that there could be children, their cousins, or their first cousins once removed that would inherit. Depending if they predecease the uncle or they predecease the great uncle, will matter whether they get the property. So over there, we might have thought in the Mishnah, when we say Royakum Mokzak is only in property where there's a doubt, there's a risk, they may not inherit it. Since there's a risk they may not inherit it, it's not considered a part of the estate until it actually comes into the estate. On the other hand, when it comes to a grandfather, where we're certain that they are in the direct line and that they will inherit. There's no matter what, they will inherit a portion of the grandfather's property because of their father. So if that's the case, maybe that is considered Mokzak. That's what the Mishnah comes to say. No, that's also called Royka Mokzak. Even if you're certain that this property will fall to them through the Yerusha, it's still not considered a part of the estate until it falls into the estate. And so Royka Mokzak applies not only to assets that are at risk, but even assets that for certain will come into the estate. All right, next Mishnah. Ve'ilu she'en chozrim be'yovel. These are certain items that are not undone at the Yovel. We know when it comes to the Yovel, that all the property goes back to its original owners. But what is considered to be an original owner, whereas Yerusha inheritance remains with the new owners. So when it comes to the Yovel, HaBechora doesn't go back. Ve'yoreshet ishto, when someone who inherits his wife, also that means permanent, and it does not go back at the Yovel. Ve'yamebeimet ishet achiv, someone who performs yibum on the wife of his brother, and he inherits for his brother, that also doesn't go back into the pot. It's not returned when it comes to the Yovel. Ve'yamatana, and anything that you were gifted. If you were gifted something during the 50 years of the Yovel comes, you keep the gift, you don't have to return it. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's the position of Rabbi Meir. Chachamim Omrim, Hamatana Kemecher. A gift is just like a transaction. And just like a transaction will be undone at the Yovel, so too a gift will be undone at the Yovel. Rabbi Lazar Omer, Kulam Chuzrim B'Yovel. Rabbi Lazar disagrees and says all of these are undone at the Yovel. Rabbi Yochanan B'Broko Omer, Hayoresh Et Ishto Yagzir Libnei Mishpacha. That when he inherits his wife, he'll return the property to his wife's family. But they will take off the value. Give it back to them. They will pay him for him, but they will deduct the amount that he owes them. Okay, it's a cryptic statement. The Gemara will deal with what exactly that means. My time with Rabbi Meir. Let's understand Rabbi Meir first. The Torah says that when it comes to the Yovel, all sales will be undone. That's not what's mentioned. The Torah mentions mecher, transactions. That's what's undone by the Yovel. Gifts and inheritance are not undone. Vahane mi Yerusha Yerusha. Anything that's classified as Yerusha in the Mishnah, that will have the din of Yerusha. De matana, matana. And anything that's a gift will be classified as a matana. So if you look in the Mishnah, you have Yoresh Adishto, which is a din of Yerusha. And therefore, he keeps it at the Yovel, because it's not classified as Mecher. And when it comes to the Bechora and Yibum, they're classified like a Bechor. And a Bechor has a classification of a Matana. Because it says by the Bechor, Latet lo Pishnayim. To give him, Pishnayim, Latet, is like giving him a Matana. Matana, Kari Rachmana. Torah calls it a matana. And according to Rabbi Meir, the Bechor is classified as a matana, but a matana is not undone at the Yovel. So Bechor and a Yavam, who is also classified like a Bechor, they will keep their property at the Yovel because they got it as a gift. And since it was gifted to them, it doesn't get undone by the Yovel. That's the way Rabbi Meir learns. Rabbi learns, if it's a Yerusha, of course you keep it. If it's a matana, you also keep it. So anything that's under the category of Yerusha stays. Anything that's under the category of matana also stays. What's under the category of matana? Well, gifts, obviously. And also Bechor and Yabam, because they're all classified as matanot. Gemara now explains, why is it? Hayoreshet ishto, when it comes to inheriting his wife, Yerushat Abal is deoraita. So that's a din in Yerusha. So when it comes to Bechor and Yabam, we said that they have a din in matana. The inheritance of his wife has a din of inheritance because the Yerushat Abal is a din midoraita. Because it says, Ki ibn she'ero akarov elav. So she'ero akarov elav is ishzu ishto, that the husband is entitled ben Torah to inherit his wife. As I mentioned before, Yobam has the same din as Bechor, and Bechor has a din of Matana. So that explains the position of Rabbi Meir. That a gift is like a transaction. It says that the properties will go back at the Yovel. That's a riboy. Not only do transactions, mecher, purchases go back at the Yovel, but all transactions, transference of ownership go back, which is matana and mecher. The only thing excluded is Yerusha. V'hani kulu Yerusha ninu. And anything mentioned in the Mishnah that doesn't go back in the Yovel are considered Yerusha. B'chor amar chumano lo teit lo pishnaim. It says you will give him a double portion. Mekish chalek b'chora lechalek pashut. The Torah puts together his extra portion along with his primary portion. The primary portion is clearly Yerusha. Machalik Pashut Yerusha. Avchalik Bechora is classified as Yerusha. So their disagreement in Rabbi Meir is at two levels. One is they believe that a Matana does return in the Yovel. Number two is that they believe a Bechor has a din of Yerusha and not a din of Matana, because the extra portion has the same din as the primary portion. As according to Rabbi Meir, since the Torah phrased it as a teit lo, the secondary portion or the extra portion is classified as a matana. So that's the two disagreements the Chachamim have with him. Now, when it comes to then Isha, we know that Yerushat Abal is deoraita, and that'll be classified as Yerusha. They will agree with that. And when it comes to Yabam, they'll say Yabam has a din like a Bechor, and a Bechor is classified as Yerusha, so too a Yabam is classified as Yerusha. So that's why the Chachamim believe in the Yovel that the Yerushat Isha, the Yerushat Yabam, and the Yerushat Bechor don't go back. But a matana does go back. Lazomer kulam chozrim biyovel. Belozer says everything goes back in the Yovel. Sever laki rabbanan. First of all, he holds like the rabbanan d'amrei tashuvu l'rabot as a matana. To say that a matana does get returned in the Yovel. V'ani kulu matana ninhu. And everything in this Mishnah is a matana. Bechor, he holds like Rabbi Meir. Latei lo pishnayim matana kar yirachmano. So whereas the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Meir on 2 points. One is that a matana does return the Yovel, and number two is that the Bechor is not classified as a matana, but rather Yerusha. But Belazer agrees with each of them on 1 point. He agrees with the Chachamim that a matana does go back on the Yovel, but he agrees with Rabbi Meir that a Bechor is classified as a matana. Since it's classified as a matana, and a matana returns on the Yovel, therefore the Bechor will have to give up his double portion at the Yovel. That's one. Vayoreshet ishto, what about Yerushat Isha? Yerushat Abal derabonon. He holds that the husband inheriting his wife is only a din derabonon. Since a din derabanan is equivalent to lokeach, he's like a buyer, and therefore a buyer, that transaction will be undone at the Yovel. V'ami abeim, the yabam, et eishirachi b'chor kariya rachman as a din of b'chor, and therefore it's classified as a matana. So all of these items are considered to be gifts or transactions, and the Yovel undoes all of them. So that's why Rabbi Lazar, or explains the position of Rabbi Lazar in our Mishnah. We mentioned before that the one who holds that it's the right learns it out of the pasuk Kim Shero Karov Elav, that Shero Zu Ishto, that's learned out of the pasuk in the Torah that he inherits his wife, and therefore it's classified as a Yerusha. On the other hand, if you don't think it comes out of the pasuk, but rather Chachamim instituted that a husband will inherit his wife, that means the Chachamim basically created a transaction here. They basically said that the woman's property will go to the husband, and it's not Yerusha. It's not Yerusha that's recognized by the Torah, and it can be undone by the Yovel. Brothers that divide up the property are considered buyers. And therefore, every Yovel will have to redivide the property. Meaning that there's ein breira, that there's, when they divide the property, it's not considered as if they got the proper piece of property. It's as if they all transacted with each other, and they got a piece of property. And therefore, every Yovel will have to go back and redivide the property between them, because they're classified like buyers, and not as Yorshim. Tosfot over here says that even though there are other Amorayim that hold that they're lukuchotein, and there are other Amorayim that think there's no breira, nevertheless, this is unique to Rabbi Yochanan. This idea that they're chuzrim beYovel is something that's specific to Rabbi Yochanan and not to any of these other Amorayim. Because Rabbi Yochanan believes that when we talk about the fact that they are lukuchot, they're literally lukuchot to the point where they have the same din as anybody else who would be a buyer. The other Amoraim have reasons, even though they're classified as lukuchot, to suggest that they still do not have to return it during the Yovel. And that's what Tosfot tries to do, is to narrow this down to Rabbi Yochanan. The second thing to note over here is that we had earlier in the Perek that Amar Rabbi Asi Rabbi Yochanan, that Rabbi Asi had a safek with regards to Yusha, and he said that they're chetzi lukuchot and chetzi yoshim. That's a much bigger sugya that we're not going to deal with now, but you have to reconcile between Rav Asi's statement here that they're classified as lukuchot and Rav Asi's statement earlier in the Gemara that said misvakkale, the Rabbi Asi was in doubt as to it, and therefore he made them partly lukuchot and partly yoshim. Alright, so now the Gemara continues. Motiv Rav Hoshaya. So we ask from our Mishnah on this position of Rav Asi and Rav Yochanan. Ve'elu she'en chuzrim be'yovel. These don't go back in the Yovel. Ha'bechorah. One of the items that doesn't return in the Yovel. Amalei Rabbi Lazar, mayin chuzrin. What does it mean that they don't go back in the Yovel? In chuzrin levatala. That he doesn't lose his right as a bechorah. When they redivide the property again in the Yovel, he's still entitled to his double portion. Not that the division of the property doesn't get undone at the Yovel. It does get undone in the Yovel. And the Mishnah says, in chuzrin be'yovel means that they don't go back to being all pshutim. The Bechor retains his right as a Bechor, and when they redivide the property in the Yovel, he will also get a double portion again. That's a major rereading of our Mishnah right now. Instead of saying in Chuzrin means that they don't undo the transaction at all, we're now saying they do undo the transaction, but the rights of the Bechor is still there. He still has the right to divide and get a double portion. Matkiv la Rav Sheshet. Rav Sheshet then asks on this, Miklau, demand amar Chuzrin, meaning Rabbi Lazar, who believes that by the Bechor it does go back, Chuzrin levatala kamar, he believes that when it comes to the Yovel, the Bechor is no longer entitled to a double portion. Which means that the double portion of the Bechor is for the period until the Yovel. When the Yovel comes about, the Bechor now loses all rights and he becomes like a regular brother when they redivide the property. That's what you're suggesting Rabbi Lazar would say in our Mishnah. The Gemara says, Kari Rav Chama alei de Rav Sheshet. Chama said about Rav Sheshet, Tova chachma im nachala. Velo Shmiele, and he hadn't heard of this, ha dechiati Rabbanam Rabbi Yochanan, the memra of Rabbanam Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Lo, Rabbi Lazar, Amar, Mishum, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, my chuzrin, chuzrin levatala, that ain't ochanami. When Rabbi Lazar spoke in our Mishnah, that their chuzer in the Yovel does not mean that they redivide the property only, no, but it means they redivide the property, plus the Bechor loses all of his rights. So we do have a memra from the Amoraim that supports that understanding of the Mishnah. What the statement of Rabbi Chama about Rav Sheshet is somewhat of a machloket here. It's a question of whether it's a positive statement or a negative statement. The position of Tosafot and Rashi is that Rav Sheshet was endowed with many brightot. He was a Baal Mesora. But the criticism, or the veiled criticism that Rav Chama was given was that Tova Chachmaim Nachla, that you can't just have all the brightot, you need Chachma as well. You need the member of the Amoraim. You need to know from your Rebbe, or you need to have the Mesorah of the Amoraim. Had he known the Mesorah of the Amoraim, his question would have been moot. Because we do have a member of Amoraim which supports that understanding of the Mishnah, and therefore he wouldn't have had a question. So it's a veiled criticism of Rav Sheshet. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it as Tova Chachma im Nachla, which is Chachma means he was a very bright, he was sharp, and Nachla, he had a great Mesorah. He was both an Oker Harim and a Mari Chitaya. And he was endowed with everything, and that's why he had such a sharp question. But despite the fact that he had such a sharp question, he didn't know about this memra of the Amoraim, which would have answered his question. But that's not a criticism. It's a compliment to Rav Sheshet. And he says, despite that compliment, he didn't know this memra of the Amoraim. That's why Rabbeinu Gershom reads it. Rashi and Tosafot say, no, it's a veiled criticism. Had he known this memra of the Amoraim, he would never have asked the question. And that's what it means. Tova nachalai, tova chachmaim nachla. Right, now to finish up the parak. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broko omer, ha-yoreshet ishto yagzir li-bnei mishpacha. My kasavar, what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka hold in the Mishnah? Ikasavar yusheta baal doraita. If the baal inherits his wife, the husband inherits his wife, mina Torah, ma yachzir lebnei mishpacha. Why does he have to give it back? Vikasavar yusheta baal derabonon. If he thinks that the inheritance of the husband is only a din derabonon from his wife, damim mayavaitayu. Why is there any payment here? They should get it back in the Ovel. Nothing to do with it. They don't have to pay him anything. So lolam kasavar yusheta baal doraita. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka believes that the inheritance of a husband of the wife is a din mina Torah. What are we doing here? Kagon, Sharishato Ishto Beta Kvarot. That, as part of what he inherited from his wife, he inherited her plot or a property in the cemetery. Because of the kavod of the family, that the family wants to retain the burial plot within the family, and to bury family members there, therefore the Rabbanan empowered the wife's family to purchase this back. They can force him to sell it back to them. So even though he's entitled to it midoraita, it's his property, nevertheless, the Chachamim instituted that they could buy it back in order to be shomer on the kavod of the family. And we have a breita that supports that. Amocher kubro, b'der kubro, someone who, because of need, sells his burial plot and the way to his burial plot. Makom mamado beit hespedo, an area around that where they used to do the mamadot, and they used to give hespedim, meaning the equivalent of a funeral home in their day. First of all, the family members can come and bury him there against the will of the buyer. Because of the kavod of the family, they're allowed to bury him there. They have to pay up in this case. They have to pay him back for the property. So what is the deduction for? The deduction is to make kever ishto. It's the obligation of the husband to bury his wife. Since the husband has an obligation to bury his wife, what they will do is the cost of the funeral of the wife, they will deduct from the amount of money they pay him. They're going to bury their daughter, sister, whoever it is from their family, and they're going to have to expend the money for that. Those expenditures, they will deduct from the money they pay him for buying back the burial plot, because the burial is the obligation of the husband. It's the obligation of the husband, it's part of the ketubah. Therefore, he has to lay out that money, and they have to pay him for the burial plot. So they'll net those two against each other, and that's the amount of money they'll have to pay him to get the plots back. And therefore, Rabbi Yochanan Bar Brocha's position is, the husband's entitled to it. If the Bnei Mishpacha want it back, they have to pay for it. The Rechamim gave him a right to do that, to force a transaction. But because the husband is chayav to bury his wife, they will deduct from that amount the cost of his wife's funeral. Okay, we'll stop over here with the completion of the parashah.